Breadbox Media Programming is brought to you by Jack Kane Ford. Find your next Ford Tough vehicle at caneford.com. Woodhill Community Center. Have a hand in the heart of the city. Support their mission with your donations at woodhillcommunitycenter.org. Toyota in Nicholasville Superstore. Online consultants are standing by right now to help you find your next Toyota. Visit Toyota on nicholasville.com. Lexus of Lexington, home of the best-selling Lexus IS. Find yours today at lexusoflexington.com. Did you know that half of America is single? Hollywood has never produced anything like this before. The Dating Project, a groundbreaking documentary that follows five single people, ages 18 to 40, as they search for authentic and meaningful relationships. There is no script. There are no actors. These are real people trying to find love and happiness in an age of swiping left or right. From Empower Pictures, Paulus Productions, Family Theater Productions, and PureFlix, you can now own The Dating Project. Save the date by visiting thedatingprojectmovie.com and go a step further and help others in your circle date differently by partnering with Ascension Press. Visit shop.ascensionpress.com to acquire the companion study guide. The Dating Project movie is now available on DVD and digital download on Amazon, iTunes, and Walmart. Please visit thedatingprojectmovie.com for details.
Good evening, my fellow truth seekers. Welcome to Beneath the Surface here at WCAP Radio. Glad you could join us tonight. Right after the Supreme Court justice was nominated publicly by President Donald Trump, our phone number here at BTS Radio, as you know, is 978-454-4980. That's 978-454-4980. If you want to get involved in our conversation, we'd love to have you. We're here until 11 o'clock tonight, from 10 to 11. Bringing a little sanity into our age of insanity, a little life into our culture of death. And with me today to speak about church-state relations and the Supreme Courts, there he is, your guest and mine, Mr. Robert LeBlanc.
Hello, Paul. Woo-hoo.
Hello, Mr. Bobbert. How are you?
I am very, very hot. And fat content and coming from a northern clime as far as my more recent ancestry.
Yes.
I am just dying up here in the booth.
So this just doesn't work for you, huh?
Yeah, this is tough. This is tough. Yeah. Like just imagine my brain on a frying pan. You remember those commercials there for the anti-drug campaign?
Yeah, I believe so.
Yep. I'm sizzling right now on the pan.
Now, your favorite season of the year is winter. Do I have that right?
Actually, no.
Oh.
My favorite season is spring, and actually there's about 3 or 4 days during the spring where I consider it absolutely perfect.
So those three, probably at the end of March, beginning of April, I would guess. Right around that time.
It's more toward the second half of April.
Okay, the April area is your favorite. See, my favorite month is June.
Is that right?
Yeah. So I like end of spring, beginning of summer. That's my favorite. But I love summer.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, I do.
Well, you know, this summer has been actually pretty good overall. I mean, it's been kind of cool, except for the past couple of weeks. You know, I couldn't really complain, except I'm complaining now because, you know.
Well, you can complain tomorrow, too, because it's going to be in the early 90s. But then after that, it'll drop a little bit, and we'll have
a little bit of rain.
Mediocre summer weather rather than real hot. 978-454-4980 is our phone number. We are heard on WCAP Radio as well as all over the internet and the World Wide Web, not only live as we speak now, but in the form of podcasts. So just Google Beneath the Surface with Paul Morano, and you should our podcast. You might as well add that to it, our radio show or what have you, and you can hear this later on. But anyway, here we are. Another Supreme Court justice has been nominated.
Right.
Another president went through the shebang about going, you know, having his finalists and then finally choosing one. And Mr. Bob, I believe that this one probably surprised 80-85% of the people that were anticipating tonight.
No, at least what I was reading today, my hope for candidate, I heard that she had a... I hope that Amy Barrett would get selected as Supreme Court nominee.
I think most people thought that that would be the case.
And I heard this morning that she had a bad personal interview with President Trump.
Mm.
It didn't go well. Whatever reasons, I don't know what it was. But and that may have, you know, been a deciding factor. I don't know. You know, a lot of people were reading the tea leaves, and they were actually saying Kavanaugh, who was actually selected, might be the front runner for this today, as of today.
Yeah,
well, last week there was a lot, especially on Catholic kind of feeds or whatever. You were seeing a lot of people talking about Amy Barrett.
Yeah, I've been seeing it up to this day.
Oh, yeah, yeah. I saw one today, but it was a kind of a long shot kind of thing. I think she would have been a good Supreme Court nominee, but from what I've heard, Kavanaugh is also a good choice as well.
Okay, so, well, anyway, the bottom line is that President Trump did not pick any politically correct choice. He went with a white guy again.
Oh, did he? Oh,
and
yes.
To those who care about the Constitution and the makeup of the Supreme Court, it shouldn't matter what color the guy is, or what sex the guy is.
Yeah, all those things are really immaterial as far as the Supreme Court justice. I definitely have strong opinions about what a Supreme Court nominee or what a Supreme Court justice should be doing, and I'm sure people on the left would disagree with me. Maybe, I don't know.
Okay.
I'm kind of a strict constitutionalist type of person, so it's not what the Supreme Court justice wants as a final result, but rather whether or not. The laws that they're reviewing or the cases that are before him is what does the law say? What does the Constitution say
about it?
Yeah,
Neil Gorsuch said something like that during his process. He said that there's going to be some verdicts that I come down on that I really don't like.
Yeah,
and that's what it means to be a good Supreme Court justice.
I believe so. Yeah,
yeah. And
if we want to continue on my opinion about how the Supreme Court should run,
okay.
we've kind of in these modern days we've gone from a kind of a more close to the Constitution rendering to usurping the congressional role of writing laws. And in fact, what you see sometimes is the Congress will write a law and they'll say, well, you know, the Supreme Court will fix it up if there's anything unconstitutional in it, which is contrary to what the United States was doing during the 19th century. You had all the political branches involved in constitutional issues before the Congress passed a law, you know, it usually had, well, it would have arguments whether a particular law is constitutional or not in Congress itself.
Right.
And then, of course, the president would look at it and he would have his own input whether the law is constitutional or not before we even got to the Supreme Court. But now it seems like Congress is just kind of giving away its legislative authority.
And is this one of the reasons why Congress has such a low rating, you think?
It may be.
They're just not doing their job?
They're not doing their job. They're, you know, in a way, I'm calling the whole group of them cowards. That they refuse to really deal with. Like, the immigration issue is an issue that should have been dealt with legislatively.
Totally.
But it's a hot button issues, and all of them, they seem more concerned about getting reelected rather than doing what needs to be done as far as...
decades.
Yes, decades.
Many decades.
Since the 1980s, as far as I can remember.
Before that.
So there seems to be kind of like, hey, if we can get reelected and not really do anything dangerous politically...
Then do you believe, Mr. Bob, that it is best for the Republic that congressmen have term limits?
No, I don't believe that.
You don't? Even after what you just said?
Yes.
Because you're saying that all they do is kick the can down the road on important issues because they want to get elected.
Right.
If you're not worried about getting reelected...
Yeah, well, the real problem here... Well, the reason why I'm opposed to it, I remember reading a very good book on it. It's by George Will called Restoration. And it's a really great book on political philosophy. I always go back to it. But I disagreed with George Will's conclusion, saying that term limits was necessary.
Because?
Well, it turns out that when you actually apply term limits, what it really does is pushes the can down. What it becomes is congressional staff becomes the important people, because you got all these people who don't know what they're doing moving into Congress, so the congressional staffs become the power within the Congress, rather than having the individual legislators.
You have to be there for a while in order to know what you're doing?
Yeah. There's a really good thing to have some leaders of Congress being there for a long time.
But can't you say the same thing about the executive? And they're only there for one or two terms.
Yeah. I think when you try to deal with corruption, and I think this is kind of a form of corruption, when you try to deal with corruption through laws, you're just going to move the corruption to someplace else. You're not actually... there are rare cases where I'd say, oh, that law made a lot of sense in correcting corruption. But I think a lot of times you just move the corruption. You don't actually solve the problem. And I don't have a good solution for dealing with this other than improving the people of the United States.
So it seems like term limits are bad and not having term limits are bad. Because both...
Yeah.
Both are,
well,
result
the problem,
in
the
bad
problem is that we're selecting leaders that don't have very good character.
So you need to select leaders who don't care about getting reelected.
You need to select
principle over person.
Principled, that they love their country to a very high extent. I don't know if it's necessarily maybe a lack of love of country. I think it may be just a lack of good character that we see.
Well, like you said, I think you hit it. They want to stay there.
The culture has kind of changed in the way a lot of these legislators think of this as a job rather than their servants of the people. That you're doing it. The intention is, and maybe we'll get to the Constitution here. The intention would be that these would be citizens who have matured, living in a life outside of being a politician, and then they would go be elected to Congress or something like that with a little bit of experience in life, and hopefully they would have developed some sort of character in whatever they did, and they would be actually from the people. They wouldn't be specialized politicians, who took poli-sci in college and then just worked as, a congressional staff member and then ran for Congress or something like that. More of a mix. We shouldn't have a professional political class, so to speak.
And yet you don't want term limits. The less you have term limits, the more of a professional class it becomes. Because they get stuck there. And they get part of it, if you don't mind me using Trumpian language, they become part of the swamp. It's sort of they're pressured into that.
Yeah.
No?
Let's do it this way, Paul. Since you're very interested in this, why don't we do a show on term limits, and I'll prepare for it, and I'll come up with good reasonings behind why I think it's the right thing to do. I don't know if I'll ever get to that point, but I'm my opinion right now, and it's I have some reasons, but it's mostly instinctual, is that term limits are a bad idea.
For the president also?
Yeah, I think so.
Really?
Yeah.
They should be able to continue to run forever until...
The reason why we came up with term limits is that FDR broke the convention. You know, up to, George Washington became president, and he stayed for two terms, willingly stepped down. Every president up to that point had served only two terms as president, and FDR just said, I don't care about that. I think I'm more important than following this this thing. So he stayed on.
But according to you, so what? That's a good thing.
Well,
or it could be.
No, I think that FDR probably should have obeyed the convention, but who knows? I'm not going to be, you know, strictly for one thing or the other. I think there might have been good reasons. I don't think FDR's reasons were good. It actually showed the corruption that the presidency had developed. People were very afraid of FDR and the power that had developed, and it's only gotten worse since then. It didn't really stop things.
978-454-4980 is our phone number here beneath the surface. And there's the break. You know what? We have to take a quick commercial break, but after that, and we're going to talk more about this and the Supreme Court justice nominee and so forth, but I do want to ask you one beneath the surface question.
Sure. But
when we come back, and I'll... Should I ask it now? No, I tell you what. I'll ask it when we get back.
All right.
All right, so don't go anywhere. You're listening to Beneath the Surface. Paul Morano here with my guest, Mr. Bob LeBlanc. Don't go anywhere. We'll be back right after this. And we're back. You're listening to Beneath the Surface. Paul Morano here with my guest, Bob LeBlanc. Speaking about the separation and relationship between church and states, including how it relates to the Supreme Courts. All right, Bob, we were talking about the structure of government before the break.
A very good constitutional thing there.
Yep. And I told you that after the break I had a beneath-the-surface question I wanted to ask you.
I hope you remembered it because you didn't tell me.
Yes, I didn't tell you during the break. Okay, you vouched for that. Do you think that the United States government and its form is exceptional, unique, and a good and workable form of government because it reflects the Trinitarian nature of God as the three branches of government, God being three persons and one God?
That is something very, very interesting that I've not given a lot of thought.
I'm surprised. I've been thinking about that for all my adult life.
Really?
Yeah.
Well, it was new for a national government. I mean, the colonists had that sort of three-part separation. Though I don't know if it was widely held or whether people thought that it could really hold together. So it was exceptional in that sense. Benjamin Franklin at the end of the Constitutional Convention, somebody asked him, you know, what did we get for a government? And he said, a republic, if you can keep it.
Yeah.
And that sort of thing should always be in every American's thought, is that even though it's proved to be robust so far, it is actually a pretty fragile thing. It really does depend, and we talked about this earlier.
If you can keep it, what does it depend on?
It depends on the nature of the people of the country.
The nature of the people, as in whether they are virtuous or not.
Yes.
Is that what I'm hearing?
That is what you're hearing.
A virtuous people cannot keep a republic.
No. No, eventually things will become so bad that people will demand a king or a tyrant to provide them the safety and security that you need from government.
So in other words, the less self-government there is, the more state government there must be to fill the void.
Yeah.
And virtue is basically self-governance, self-discipline.
Right. I mean, who are the people that really control the federal government? I mean, it's the voters. If they're voting out of their own self-interest rather than for the common good, then you're not really going to see that at the higher levels of government.
Look, I've been following United States governments and elections and primaries and ever since I was a little kid.
Mm-hmm.
I was one of those crazy third graders that went into class. Politicking for my favorite candidate.
Oh, you beat me by one grade level.
Yeah, I was really into Hubert Humphrey at the time.
Oh yeah.
Yeah. Yeah.
The first election that I remember being emotional about and charged up about was the 72 election between McGovern and Nixon.
McGovern and Nixon, and who are you for?
Who was I for then?
Yeah.
I think I might have been just following the crowd, so I was going for McGovern.
Okay, yeah.
But the first one where I was really independent was for the Carter Ford election.
Mm-hmm.
And I just knew that I was a more Republican person, which is kind of a funny thing.
You were more of a Republican person than I was at that time because I was hoping for Jimmy Carter to be reelected.
Oh, no, this is...
I'm sorry, to be elected, to be elected in 76.
Yeah. Okay, I guess so. Can we go to this Constitution and religious freedom stuff?
Yeah, but I think you made an extremely good point as we go to that stuff, that if you are not a virtuous people and you do not have proper self-governance, then, of course, that is going to be that void is going to be taken by higher governmental authorities.
This may be a good segue here because the founding fathers, almost universally, there would be some exceptions, I think, but almost universally thought that religion was the thing that was going to bring morality to the people. So they would say a moral people, but a lot of the founding fathers would also say a Christian and moral people.
Yeah, no, I just want to just clarify something here, because when you say the term religion in the context of the 18th century, they're not talking about Buddhism.
No.
They're not talking about Islam. They're not talking about Hinduism.
That wasn't really on their radar at
they're
the time.
They're not talking about any other ism other than Christianity. And that's a unity. That's not even an ism.
Right. Well, there were some Jewish folks.
Yeah, the Judeo-Christian heritage.
Yes.
Tradition.
Yeah, and there was that. I mean, obviously, there is a famous treaty that we made up with Libya. I don't know if you know the history at the time. The United States, as a young country, was having a little bit of difficulty protecting its own civilian sailors, and what would happen is the War of 1812 was about British people conscripting Americans into the British Navy, and the same sort of thing was happening in the Mediterranean and I think maybe in the Atlantic, was that the Barbary pirates were grabbing ships, demanding ransoms and all that sort of stuff, and they were based mostly off of North Africa and Libya. And there was a treaty made that the Senate ratified that talked about that the United States was not a Christian country. And by that, what they meant is that the United States did support religious pluralism.
Yes.
They weren't going to try to force Muslims who came to the country and force them to become Christians.
Okay.
They would be able to, have the free exercise of their religion.
No, when are we talking about right now?
We're talking about the late 18th century.
Okay, because in the late 18th century, I don't believe that they thought that non-European, non-Christian folks would be coming here. Did they? Did they have
No. It's in the treaty, it talks about if they didn't use Islam or Muslim, they used Mohammedan.
Okay, Mohammedanism.
Yeah,
okay.
as what they refer to them, and they said that these people, they wouldn't have any problem if they came over.
They wouldn't be forced,
to
worship in any other way. Okay.
And so it's just an extension of the religious pluralism between the various sects. Now, there was this as an idea, and maybe we should go into the history of it. There was this ideal of religious freedom, but in practice, it wasn't always perfect.
Okay.
And as a Catholic, I'm very aware of that because there's a strong anti-Catholic bias throughout time in the United States, which has really only kind of died down maybe during the 1980s and the 1990s, when evangelical Protestants and Catholics joined together for all the social issues.
Yeah. Well, wait a minute, though. It died down in as much as Protestants were against Catholicism. That died down. But the secular world against Catholicism has really ramped up.
Yes, it is. What Philip Jenkins, he's an Episcopal historian.
Mm. Yeah.
He's Episcopal in the sense that he is part of the Episcopal Church, or at least when he wrote this book called Anti-Catholicism, The Last Acceptable Prejudice.
Right.
Well, he said the new anti-Catholicism. And what he was talking about there is not that the Protestants were going against the Catholics. It was now these secular forces that were going against the Catholic churches, these liberal progressive forces that were attacking the Catholic Church.
Yeah, secular progressivism, they know who their one enemy really is. And it's not evangelicals, even though they give lip service to that.
But I wanted just to point out, historically, it's been a tough road for Catholics in the United States, even though ideally they had this great idea. I'm not going to knock their idea of religious pluralism in the United States, this idea of allowing people to freely express and practice their religion in the United States.
You know what saddens me between you and I and anyone who's listening? That by and large, in general, Catholics instead found themselves in this position historically, but instead of being strong and seeking to change the culture to what they believed was right and true, they kind of capitulated in as much as they wanted to be more assimilated into American culture.
Yeah, it was intentional.
In order to have more of that piece of the American pie.
Yeah.
And to me, that was the downfall of the influence, or the great influence of Catholicism in the world.
What you say is true, but I think there's maybe a little bit more nuance that we should apply to this, is that American Catholics in America wanted to show that they could be good Americans.
Yeah, but too much. They wanted to show that a little too much, in my opinion.
Whether it was too much or not, I just wanted to kind of defend. It wasn't out of material things that
I think it may have been a combination of both.
You know, this sort of anti-Catholicism comes back all the way back from the British.
Well, that makes sense.
A lot of people don't realize, and one of the things I want to talk about is the religious test. And the religious test stuff happened in merry old England. If you remember King Henry VIII, he came up with an act of supremacy. And what that did for people like St. Thomas More, may he pray for us up there in heaven.
Yes.
He was trying to say, well, the King of England is supreme in England. There's no other foreign loyalty that you should have.
Secular or religious.
Secular or religious. And St. Thomas More refused to give the oath to the king only.
Yes.
Because he was still a Roman Catholic.
Yeah.
And eventually they decided to accuse Sir Thomas More of being a treason because he still was loyal to the Pope. And off went his head.
Yes.
That was one kind of religious test. Further down the time, in order to hold office or go to university, you had to receive communion from the Church of England, which I think maybe a lot of people don't understand that in open communion times now. But back then, what religious communion you went to receive, Holy Communion from, was very, very important. It said what doctrines and dogmas that you are following.
Yes.
Another later religious test was actually on transubstantiation.
Okay.
So if you...
Well, one of my favorite words, but I would say about 5% of the audience knows what it means.
Yeah, well, why don't you say it? I think you say it better than I would.
Well, it comes from the Greek, the notion of substance, that everything that is of a thing in and of itself as a substance. Like this piece of paper is a substance. The whiteness of it, the shape of it, the feel of it, all of that are the attributes or accidents. So the substance of the bread changes. Trans means change, right? So transubstantiation
changes.
Is that by a miracle of God from heaven, the substance of the bread and wine, which really begin as bread and wine, literally change to the body and blood of Christ. And, yes. And he did that first at the Last Supper, and that continues. He gives that power to his ordained priest to continue to do it throughout history until he comes again.
And transubstantiation is fairly unique to Catholicism. It's not present in the Reformation in the Protestant side of things. That you get some things close to that, but not a true out-and-out replacement.
And not only that, Catholics would say that Protestants, by and large, do not have the power to do that because they don't have apostolic succession.
Right.
They don't have the power given to them from the bishops.
And
from Christ, ultimately.
Yeah. So up to the 19th century, Catholics were forbidden from holding office, going to university, until the 19th century. And still, even now, as far as the throne of the United Kingdom, it's anybody but Catholics. Muslim could hold the throne of the British crown or the United Kingdom, but a Catholic could not. They would have to renounce the Catholicism in order to become
king
or queen.
And the latest princess, the one that just married, what's his name? The actress.
Harry or William.
Yeah. The one that just married Harry. Just give me your name. You got it. It's at the top of my head. Meghan Markle. Markle.
I don't know this stuff. I really don't know about who's there.
I don't know what religion she was, but I do know that, I know she went to a Catholic
school.
I know that. That doesn't necessarily mean she was Catholic. But she did renounce whatever she was in order to be baptized into the Anglican Church before she married Harry.
Okay.
Yeah.
Maybe she was never baptized.
Or maybe she was never baptized, either one or the other. But she became Anglican right before the wedding. So,
it sort of reflects
what you're saying.
Happens. So, you have to remember, in Europe, there was the Reformation happening. There were wars, religious wars that were happening, and in England, there was a lot of friction that was happening in the Protestants about how, Mass should be celebrated, or whether Mass should be celebrated at all, or whatever.
Okay.
In England, they view the Church of England as the middle way between Protestantism and Catholicism.
Okay.
But there was a lot of fighting during the 17th century over who was going to be the king, what religion would you be.
And the religion of the king or queen would become the religion of the people, right?
Right. So this is the establishment part of things. We're moving from religious test to establishment. The Church of England was the established church.
Where the First Amendment gets its teeth, doesn't it?
Yes, absolutely. This is what they're talking about. With the First Amendment, when they talk about the establishment of religion, they're not talking about religion broadly spoken of, but they're talking about all these various sects. Like, if you were a Baptist, and a Baptist became king,
or president,
that would mean that's your national religion.
Right. And the Constitution keeps the United States from that happening.
And the other interesting thing, too, here is that various states at the ratifying of the Constitution did have state religions, so they did have established religions. Massachusetts would have been more congregational. Virginia was Episcopalian, which comes from Church of England,
right? The Americanized version.
The Americanized version of that. So you had various established religions in the states.
Now let me understand this as we hear the music for the second break. Are you saying that states had the right to establish religions, but the federal government did not?
Yes.
I want to get more into that and the ramifications of all of that. You're listening to Beneath the Surface here at WCAP Radio. I'm Paul Morano. with my guest this week, Mr. Bob LeBlanc, talking about church-state issues as well as the Supreme Court's. Don't go away. We'll be right back. Here's the music. Back away, 978-454-4980. If you want to call us and get in with our conversation, we'd love to have your 2 cents. 978-454-4980. You're listening to Beneath the Surface until 11 o'clock. And then comes Cindy's Vinyl Vaults. Okay. My guest, Bob LeBlanc. Where were we before the break?
We were talking about the establishment of religion in the
States. I was very surprised at that, even though I did hear about it before. You sort of jarred a memory. So tell me about this notion that states have a right to establish religion, and why don't? When did they stop doing that, and why?
I don't know if it's exactly right. I'm kind of opposed to the establishment of religion at the state level, but requiring it absolutely, I think, becomes a problem. I think that we should have some sort of subsidiarity here. That there should have some local exceptions, I guess, depending on the religious situation on the ground. I guess I'm saying there's not a one solution fits the entire nation.
Well, we already know that the federal government put that in the First Amendment that they shall not establish a religion.
A federal national religion.
So the question is it constitutional to establish a state for Massachusetts or New Hampshire or what have you?
According to the Supreme Court, this started happening during. During the 20th century, the early 20th century, they started looking at the 14th Amendment and saying, hey, because of the 14th Amendment, we're now incorporating the First Amendment as applying to the states.
And how did they rationalize that? What did the 14th Amendment say
about equality and due process. And the equality thing, I think, is the important thing here. They looked at it and they said, well, you can't really be equal if you have an established religion at the state level.
So equality demands freedom of conscience. I think that goes back to the First Amendment.
It does. It does. That's what I would talk about as far as generally what the First Amendment is talking about is that freedom of conscience. This is the very good thing about what Americans at the founding period, they really discovered this kind of pluralism. I mean, you had Maryland was the first state to actually, it was Catholic. It was Lord Baltimore.
Yeah.
He established a Catholic province, and eventually Catholics lost power in Maryland, and the Protestants reversed that religious freedom thing and really kicked the Catholics out of government in Maryland. The second religious freedom grouping was actually, I think, Pennsylvania and New Jersey, and this was I can't remember his name. He's a Quaker. I can't remember what his name is off the top of my head right now. Anyways, but they were Quakers, and they experienced Massachusetts having this kind of intoleration for their particular sect, and so they said, "Wait, when we form our own colony here, we're going to have religious freedom here." And so some of it was actually kind of a good thing where the religious intolerance produced a counter reaction where people are saying, you know, if I want religious freedom, then yeah. I really should give it to these other folks who aren't quite the same.
But could you just to play the devil's advocate, couldn't you say that it's a free country if you want to go to another state's religion, go move to another state?
Well, people weren't as mobile back then, I don't think.
So that would be an unrealistic or an unreasonable
thing to ask. I think so. Well, I mean, a lot of people travel across the Atlantic for religious freedom, so that kind of undercuts my argument, but why should you force a person to move if they've established themselves someplace? Like, in particular, like in Maryland, Catholics suddenly having a lot of religious toleration and freedom. all of a sudden find themselves, you know, they've lived there all their lives, all of a sudden they find themselves out of government, you know, and they, I don't know if you heard of the dhimmitude that Muslims practice on Christians. So what the Protestants did to the Catholics is they taxed them heavily because they're Catholic,
okay,
which is what the Muslims do in some Islamic states, or most, I don't know.
Okay, and so things like that would violate the Constitution?
Now, yes, absolutely. You couldn't have saying the Episcopal religion is now the state religion of Virginia.
Do you see any potential danger here in applying the notion that all human beings are created equal to all religions are equal?
Yeah.
That mentality seeping into the national consciousness.
Well, this is the problem. The United States is a Protestant nation, a majority Protestant nation.
Yeah.
And a lot of things come out of that mentality. There's this focus against authority that you have here in America. There's even Catholics kind of have that. And the Catholic religion is something that accepts authority from beyond the individual.
Loves authority.
Loves authority.
At least in essence, because the authority is God himself in Christ.
Through the Pope and through all the bishops.
Through his own channels that he established when he was on earth, yes.
Right. And Protestants tend to put that freedom of conscience at a private level much, much higher than Catholics would. But it's a good thing in this sense is that they really did recognize that conscience is important. You don't want to force people to worship a God that they don't believe in. You don't they're not going to get to heaven that way.
No.
You know, nobody is forced into heaven.
Right.
And so allowing that sort of toleration and actually we need to remember what toleration is about.
What is it about?
Well,
It's become a buzzword today.
It becomes a buzzword, but actually toleration is recognizing that there may be some sort of error here, but we're going to allow it anyways.
A certain degree of error is okay to allow for the greater good.
For the greater good.
All right.
Like I said, the greater good in this case here is allowing people to express their own individual religious freedom.
Yeah.
And that's been a boon for the United States. There's been at least three or four great awakenings in America, which were religious fervor just pumped up. I mean, people were able to choose, you know, in a certain way, according to their conscience, what they believed in. And that was kind of, that's a good thing in a certain sense. It can go overboard. But the whole idea that's new here that was not really expressed very well in the Catholic Church is this idea of religious freedom. And Vatican II kind of borrowed a little bit from...
Well, John Henry Newman was instrumental in that.
John Courtney Murray.
John Courtney Murray, okay.
Was a Jesuit priest, yeah. So there is this kind of good thing about this religious pluralism where you're not forced by the central government to believe certain things.
Yeah.
That, I think, could be a good thing if people get to know their religion better.
Yeah. Before I get to that, I just want to say that I'm looking at the internet now, and Elizabeth Warren is going crazy at the microphone podium right outside the Supreme Court.
Oh boy!
With the protest on Trump's nominee, and before her, I think was that new Hispanic lady who got elected that was supposed to be a socialist.
Yes.
So they're all taking turns here, it looks like, in trashing the nominee already. And it's funny, the moment that Trump said the name of the nominee, just about, you know, a matter of seconds, I turned over to another channel and there was a sign already, like, fight Kavanaugh.
Right.
So they probably had four signs because they knew the finalists.
Yeah. Well, I've seen various things before the nomination, and they were going to fight whoever Trump nominated.
Right.
It's become the Supreme Court has become very politicized because it has become a super legislature. So instead of deciding like things like the Roe versus Wade. Even honest progressives and liberals will acknowledge that Roe versus Wade was poorly decided. It really had little basis on the facts on the ground. The other thing is that it politicized the judicial branch, which the founding fathers really wanted to avoid. An early politicizing was FDR. He was going to pack the court. He was going to make more Supreme Court justices until he could pass his own program
right.
to do.
Well, I mean, there is politicization, no question about it. But what was I going to say? I had a point in my mind. It's one of those that just flew right out of me. What were we just talking about before that? You had a good point.
We were talking about Elizabeth Warren and these guys, or Roe versus Wade.
The politicization. Particularly with that decision. I think what you're saying is that the Supreme Court overstepped their bounds as a court, as the judiciary in the United States, and created a law rather than recognized the Constitution for what it is and brought it back to the states. So you're saying it should have been brought back to the states.
And in fact...
is that what you're saying?
Yes.
Because I want to take issue with that.
Okay, take issue with
that. All right, I do. Because in one sense, I think that the liberals had it right in as much as you first look at the Constitution to see if there's anything relating to abortion there. Now, I think they stretched it way too far with the penumbra nonsense of liberty. But... my question is, once Roe is overturned, and I think it probably will be in our lifetime, does the Constitution, in its protection of life, liberty, and property, in its protection for life, in the 14th Amendment, as well as, I believe, what is it, the First or Second?
First is about freedom of religion and free speech in the press.
Life, liberty, and property. Is that...
it might be talking about the Fifth.
There are two places in the Constitution that speaks about every human being's right to life. Now, can that be tapped to say that every human being has a right to life and that should be protected by law, regardless of what the states do?
Yes, and in fact, there was a young student who published in the Harvard Law Review about how Roe was wrongly decided on several points, and in fact, he thinks that the correct decision is up to uphold rights. So, if any state still had pro-choice laws, they could be overturned by the federal judiciary.
Well, that's why I challenged you on bringing it back to the states. Maybe it doesn't go back to, or it doesn't stay there.
We have to. I would agree with it if it went that far, but I don't think it's politically prudent. The problem is, especially when you're talking about a liberal democracy as we are in the United States, is that having the Supreme Court justices decide this is a really bad move. The best you can do is to try to reach a consensus across the board on this. What I was going to say before, and I want to finish this little point here, is that Roe versus Wade galvanized the pro-life community. There were California and New York were states that are already passed pro-abortion or pro-choice laws, and it looked like through those means that through the states we would have become a pro-choice nation individually, state by state by state, maybe with a few exceptions.
Okay, what's your point?
By deciding that, the Supreme Court deciding that, they really galvanized the pro-life movement since Roe versus Wade.
Okay, that is a point, but I think it's a minor point compared to my point, which is, does the Constitution protect the lives of all human beings?
The answer is, as I say, is yes. I believe that's the right answer
instead of bringing it back to the states and let the states become pro-abortion one after another, like you said it would happen.
The Supreme Court should have knocked down the New York and California laws.
They did with slavery. You could say that, eventually...
Sorry. It was not the Supreme Court that knocked down slavery.
Right, it was a war.
was a war. Right. It was, and it was three amendments: the 13th, 14th, and 15th amendments that that really took care of slavery, and that's again through democratic means. The Supreme Court actually went the other way.
Yeah.
With the Dred Scott decision, and it got the Union, the northern part of the Union, all up in arms about it. Which is the same sort of thing that I think happened with Roe versus Wade.
Mm.
It was a very badly, wrongly decided thing. And I think if you really want to be... Because there's no real stop here. I guess I want to go even deeper about this.
Okay, you only have 2 minutes. Less than 2 minutes.
So the Supreme Court is not the final guardian of the Constitution.
Right.
I would deny that all the way through because... They decide wrongly all the time.
They can, certainly. They're not infallible.
They're not infallible. And so, in general, I do see that the Supreme Court does have a function here, but it is not the final thing. The final backstop is actually the people of the United States themselves.
Well, yeah.
Understanding what the Constitution
is. So if the court rules wrong... objectively speaking, violating a human right here or there, the people should speak up and the legislature should change things.
Yes, absolutely.
That's how it should be, and with a more virtuous people, that's how it would work.
Right. This is the only thing that really protects the Constitution is having a virtuous people.
That has to be the last word, because that is a great last word to have.
Thank you, Paul.
Thank you for listening to Beneath the Surface. Thanks, Rob, for coming back this week.
All right.
And until next time, something to ponder here about church-state relations. Never meant to be freedom from religion, only freedom of religion. Very important line.
I get that point in here.
Well, we just did.
All right.
Thank you, everybody, for listening. Paul Morano here with my guest, Bob LeBlanc, this week. Been listening to Beneath the Surface. Stay tuned on WCAP to Cindy's Vinyl Vault. Have a great week.
Introducing the redesigned CatholicSingles.com, featuring new ways that put the spotlight on the person and their faith, not just a profile picture. For the past 20 years, faithful Catholics have used CatholicSingles.com, and the reimagined CatholicSingles.com website is ready to help single Catholics take the next step in sharing meaningful relationships with other faithful Catholics. Remember, CatholicSingles.com for faith, fellowship, and love.